To beat an illness that's incredibly powerful, we need as much ammunition as possible, really, because when it's so embedded in your psyche, an addiction, it's just you reinforce the same message about yourself and the same behavioural pattern over and over again. We need to sort of catapult ourselves out of that some way, and we need to find people that have done it. We need to find like-minded people who have walked that path, and there's loads of them out there.
Hi everybody, welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfall. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today, we've got a fantastic guest. Nearly 29 years sober, Mark Dempster grew up in Glasgow with an alcoholic father and a mother who worked long hours, leaving him to seek escape in alcohol, drugs, sex, lots of fighting and crime. His drive to become a major drug trafficker took him from Scotland to London, the Himalayas, Spain, Amsterdam, Goa and many other locations. Eventually, the lifestyle left him homeless and addicted to heroin. Today, a published author and highly successful counsellor, he remains a committed member of a 12-step program, using his lived experience to inspire and guide those still struggling with addiction. Mark, thank you for coming on This Is Powerful. Before we talk about addiction and your work, though, I'd love to go back. Where are you from and how was your upbringing?
I grew up in Glasgow, born into a sort of family, where a Catholic family, really, in Glasgow, where of sort of Irish descent. My mum was really quite a staunch Catholic, went to church all the time. And my dad really was a sort of beginning of alcoholism, really. And I sort of Jack the Lad, loved. There was a place called the Barrowland where they all used to go dancing back then. He was a bit of a player, I would say, in his day. He was quite a good looking man. My mum was obsessed with him when she met him. But it was a sort of rock bottom, really. It was poor. You know, they were poor. Because my father's alcoholism, he was quite unsuccessful at the crime that he'd done. It wasn't like any sort of big scale, although he had a sort of quite serious lawyer, because he got into a really serious crime later on. But the kids around, it was sort of tenement buildings. It was the 60s, the mid-60s. There was loads of gangs. Each area of Glasgow was separated by different gangs. We were the the Young Scots and Fleet, but there was another gang just next to it called the Cumbie. And of course, the Gorbals had the Tongs, which was Jimmy Boyle's gang. And so there was so many different sort of influences as well. There was the Celtic Rangers, the Catholicism, the sectarianism. And it was mostly, you know, at that time, really, if you think culturally, there was a lot of, there was sort of quite a big Pakistani community, Bangladesh community that came in. There was sort of racism towards them, I think, because they got on and done. They were successful. They all sort of joined in together and they created little sort of corner shops and they sort of made money. And I think the working class men and women, really, who worked on building sites or whatever they'd done, would be envious of them.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because they talk about gangs in London now as if it's a new phenomena. As if there's never been gangs, but there's been gangs all the time through
history.
But it's a good picture what you're painting, because I experienced that. There was that in the early 70s as well, because of Labour was in.
Labour
and tax on a corporation was 98%. If you wanted to take your money, it was a 3-day working week.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a compression there, isn't there? And I think you just described it really well. So the hope is not exactly firing on all cylinders, is it?
No, there's a lack of opportunity, isn't it? How do you get in that environment? Right, it's the crab bucket analogy, isn't it? Like, MD that sort of tries to get out the bucket, or who the other crabs pull them back in. It's like, so MD, like, whether it's the Bangladeshis or the Pakistani community, like, it doesn't really matter. Or it could be Scottish guys who are a bit more entrepreneurial that want to, there's not much, they get sort of demonized really because of the underlying sort of feelings of envy that people have, because because it's bleak, it's depressing.
And it's almost like betrayal. You're leaving us, how dare you? Yeah. We were in this together.
Yeah.
You know, around the can with the wood in it, and you're leaving, so you're a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, so that's actually a nice narrative, I think, that's switched. Definitely in the last decade over here, that actually if you're a little entrepreneur and you can do stuff, then you can help pull people out if you're in an environment that's not great.
And I think also, right, the other sort of, the way people are separated, like as in the Catholic Protestant thing. So you've got these sort of factors where you go to school and you are, and you don't speak to, I mean, not that I've really done it to some degree. I've done it to some degree, but not, but you're in a Catholic school, you don't speak to Protestants, and because they're like the other side, really, the Celtic, or you might speak to them, but when it comes to the Saturday, when you go to that football game, you could wind up sort of beating the shit out.
So you said about your dad's alcoholism, but it was at the beginning.
Yeah, I think it was the early stages. I don't think he had fully, when he was 25, I was, so really, my dad didn't, I would say he got sort of coerced into, I don't really, because I've never really had a deeper conversation about what actually happened, but he got my mother pregnant out of wedlock. She's a Catholic, he's a Catholic. His father was like, Eddie, and this is 64, do you know, if you were pregnant out of wedlock and you're a Catholic woman, you were like, you get shunned. I mean, you'd really properly get shunned in them communities, which is really sad, because my mum at the time, I remember her telling me that she felt suicidal when she was, a little bit emotional about that actually, because my mum died recently and I really loved her, you know, like I really loved her a lot. And when she got pregnant, she was like, oh, what do I do? And she was only 21. My father was only 25. He was like going to the Barrowland all the time, picking up girl, you know, like, just before he met my mum, and I don't know when that sort of changed, but as a man, I think he was really proud that he had a son, and he might have thought at that time, oh, this will be the thing that will sort of straighten me up or make me more responsible or get me on track. But of course, his alcoholism, which back then, I mean, look, there's 12-step meetings everywhere and self-help groups and podcasts and everything, but there's so much exposure to recovery now as a younger person. But back then there was a lot of shame attached to being an alcoholic. If you think of the culture, like they are, and I'm sure yours is similar, Paul, in the respect that there was so much denial around alcoholism that we drink hard, we work hard, we drink hard, we give our pay packet, we take out some money from the pay packet, we give the rest to our wife. She should be happy. I mean, this is what they're like. She should be happy if we spend, you know, like as long as we give her the money, I'll give them the money, and we're looking after the house, we're allowed to drink as much as we like. It's funny because as a kid, I remember running around in these, in this tent, like in the Friday and Saturday night, and they would have these parties, and everybody would be bringing drink, they'd all be bringing a box of whiskey and stuff, and they'd all sing songs, they would all have, and there was individuals who had particular songs that they would go, oh, Jerry, sing fucking Neil Diamond, Cracklin' Rose, and they would basically, so you'd have these sort of character, like these sort of larger-than-life characters all drinking, all getting smashed, and then singing songs, and then somebody be up dancing, and there was a sort of camaraderie-ship, and within the social deprivation, I think the only bit of light that came through was when, on that Friday and Saturday night, when they were all having a drink and partying, but of course, what would happen after so many drinks, a fight would break out, or somebody's done this. And
but did you notice, Mark, how that had affected him?
Yeah.
As it went on?
As a child, I was really connected with my mother, and she was very sort of nurturing and loving. But my dad, because of his alcoholism, he as that started to progress, he would really, he'd be emotionally unavailable. He wasn't, as a man anyway, he'd find it really difficult to express emotions. There wasn't really totally different from the way I converse with my kids, or I have conversed with my kids up until now. It's really like the sort of opposite, where I'd say, I love you, and come here, give us a hug, and that type of sort of freedom to just really be emotionally, what's going on, let's sit down. My son's just breaking up with his girlfriend recently, and I was able to really sort of sit with him, but I never had that with my dad, and what I would notice from my dad is his addiction to alcohol was progressing, and he was a binge drinker, so he would have these binges, and he would go like days bottles of whiskey, and then he would get to a point where he was so sick, and he physically couldn't get the alcohol down anymore, and he'd just be sick, and he'd be shaking. And in each of these sort of episodes, as the years sort of went on, so maybe I witnessed it when I probably had seen it when I was quite really young, but I can't remember this, like, but I remember certainly like 5 or 6, and then him having like DTs, starting to get DTs, starting to see shit, and really been frightened for him, because I couldn't understand, you know, like, because you're a child, you can't equate what's, I just think he's having a heart attack or something's happening with his health, not really even knowing what's going on. And then he would sober up, and then there'd be a period of calm, right? So he'd start going to meetings, but he wouldn't really get involved, he wouldn't stay connected with meetings, because he'd get into like his pride, his false pride, what I'm talking about, not his sort of sense of real pride and how he is as a man, but the sort of ego attachment, if I'm sharing, if I'm being vulnerable, they'll see it as weakness. Why do other men help each other? You know, have they got some agenda? Is there a sexual element? All of this would come into play. And then he'd get to, and I remember as a kid going to see him, my mum, and then he'd get arrested. He kept getting arrested all the time for stealing cars. He used to steal cars a lot, and he loved joyriding cars. And so there'd be these sort of like, where he'd get sober, he'd be sober, he'd go to work, and then he'd have another episode. My mum would be phoning up his work, covering for him, saying, oh, he's really ill and all the rest of it. Eventually he'd lose the jobs. And then he'd be on social security benefits, you know, and my mum would have to sort of look after that look after me in the house, and then at one point I remember him like trying to kill himself, and he wound up in a psychiatric. He wound up back then. There was no sort of treatment. There was no rehab. Like there was no rehabs in this country. And he wound up in a psychiatric, because that's what used to happen. Often yeah. They used to wound up in psychiatric.
And I think that's hard to explain to people what the DTs are.
Yeah, like delirious tremors, yeah.
Because if you don't know, it's if you've ever seen it, I've witnessed it, a person does look nuts because they're actually seeing things that they think is there, you know, and they're shaking uncontrollably and just in sweats and stuff. So it appears like you probably do need to go somewhere like that. But once that's out of your system, you pretty much normalize, don't you?
Yeah. Once it's out your system, and then it's just a matter of you've not got the toxins, you've not got, you know, the toxins in the body. So then your body sort of climatized, you know, the liver, everything, unless you get cirrhosis, the liver, the body repairs quite quickly, generally. From as soon as, like, maybe I think roughly about 3 weeks without ethanol, it's almost cellular, and a cellular level it starts to sort of really repair, comes back within 3 months. It's like sort of you're back to sort of absolute normal functioning. But of course, if you treat just the alcohol, right? So here's the difference, isn't it? Like, my father was a dry drunk, and dry drunk being that he would address the symptom of the addiction, like, i.e. the alcohol, right? So this is the problem. The problem is the alcohol. This is how he would view it, right? If I just deal with the alcohol and detox and stop, then that's it, happy days. But no, it wasn't happy days at all, because he was still the same man, right? If you don't change, so nothing changes. He had the same thinking, the same emotional state. The only thing that changed was the behaviour. He wasn't going for the drink all the time, but he had a lot of the rage, a lot of the anger. He felt, and he wasn't sort of surrendered to the fact, you know, like, say, conceding to your innermost self. He didn't concede to his innermost self that it's an illness, right? That he suffers from an illness. He would just see it as like, oh, you know, I can just stop for a while, I'll get things under control, like, I'll get my life back together again, and at some point I'll be able to have a drink again. That's what he kept doing for years. For decades, really. And this is the sort of definition of insanity thing. It's like he'd keep on repeating, and so when he was sober, he was quite miserable, you know. He'd be like, always like really grumpy, because instead of thinking like, you know, I'm giving up this one thing to get everything in my life, he's thinking the one thing is my life. I'm giving up my whole life to get sobriety. You know, it's like, where's my fun? Where's my excitement? And also the influences around him, the other people, and this is really attributed to me as well when I eventually got sober and clean, but is that, and this is important really, my father really done a lot of the heavy lifting for me, because by his mistakes as a kid, I could see when I get into recovery, I can see if he doesn't engage that, you know, he's really got to change his personality. He's got to change his thinking and his feelings. And, well, he's got to, you know, then he's going to keep on going back. I could get that. Like, so when I got sober, I was like, all right, actually, when they were saying, oh, it's just, these are symptoms, drugs, alcohol, the gambling, the sex, whatever, you know, food, you know, over-exercise, whatever the addictive outpouring is, then that, oh, that's just a symptom. What I have to do is, why am I trying to fill this void, or why am I trying to escape from my internal dialogue? Why do I not like myself? Why do I keep doing something that obviously indicates that there's a level of self-loathing that I have?
That was sharp of you to see then, and nice that you said that you really had done the heavy lifting.
I done it.
In a sad way.
I know. There was a moment and later on in years, and there was a moment, Paul, when I got, he was open to being sober, and I was sober 2 years at a time. I'd just come back from a world convention, a convention in San Diego, San Jose. And I sort of said to him, we should go, me and you. You've never really been out of Glasgow. You'd been to like Spain or something for a week holiday, Valencia or something. But that was it. I says, we and you should go. Where do you want to go to? And where would you, of all the place? And he had this sort of fascination with Egypt and the pyramids and stuff. And I was like, right, okay, let's go. In front of the Sphinx, and I sort of got him. I said to him, let's go. We'll go on a camel. We'd been on a camel and we'd come off the camel. And I said to him, Dad, you know, look, we together, we've had years of like, you know, squabbling with each other, fighting. You were in your addiction, your alcoholism. You didn't really know. You kept slipping and you lost mum. Your mum as a result of your alcoholism. And I know you really loved, you know, like you really loved her. And there was a moment and I says, you know, and I'm your only son. And regardless of all that, I love you as my father. Regardless of what's happened in the past, I love you. And there was just clocked the sort of tears coming in his eyes. And I thought, oh, right, this is it, right? It's like you're fucking, for years I'd chased my father's attention, his love, right? I mean, like everything, like I'd be fucking acting, trying to be tough, trying to, all these ways and mechanisms that I did as a kid to try and talk about boxing all the time, talk about this, try and get him to like acknowledge that he loves me because he'd never say it. And this moment when I seen the tears in his eye, I thought, but I'm 38 now or whatever it was at the time and he's like 60. And I says, come here. Like, and I just sort of grabbed him like that and I put my hand behind his head and as I put my hand behind his head, he just started crying. He just started like literally like fucking crying like a child, you know, like sort of quite uncontrollably. And I remember just thinking, this is fucking amazing. Amazing to be able to witness and also have this experience of the real man. Like this, the mask that you've presented for years, that yeah, that's what you present, but the real, what's underneath it all, was a deep insecurity, a vulnerability, and also a softness, a gentleness that you've never let me see. Your sort of true nature. And then I sort of shared that, I don't know, 5 minutes or something, maybe he was cut. And then I says, I love you, you know, and he says, I love you, son. And then I was like, well, that's it. It's not like you could, if you died now, right? If you died now, it's done. I felt as if like it's fucking, we've had this exchange, which is something that I was chasing. I've got it. A day later, 2 days later, we're on the Nile in a boat, and he's fucking, I need to talk to him, but he's like, there's two gay guys on the boat. This is like 2002 or whatever, but he, you know, these two gay guys are holding hands on this boat going up the Nile, and it's Egypt, and it's like really fucking homophobic. And these two guys are holding, and my dad looks across, and he looks at them, and he goes, "It fucking disgusts me." He says, "It this is." He says, "It really disgusts me." And I was like, "What? What?" And then he says, "Look at them two men holding hands there. Look at that." And he's wanting me to go, yeah, I'm, you know, like to join in. But yeah. I goes, Well, I think it's really, because I'm in recovery now, and I says that's really brave, you know, and I'm not colluding with the influence, you know, and because I'm in recovery and I'm able to assert myself, and so I said, no, I think it's really brave. I mean, my God, like, imagine, like, and maybe even bordering a bit stupid, because you could they could get into trouble, and he says, well, if you had a party, would you invite people like that to your party? And I says, what do you mean, gay people? Like, to my party? He says, yeah, gay people. And I says, yeah, of course, if they were my friends. He just fucking done this stonewall, like, which was really reminiscent. Like, I'd had it all my life, you know, as a kid, I'd, like, witnessed them just, and like, he'd just look at me and he'd discuss this thing. And then, of course, I start flapping. And I'm 38 years old. I'm starting to flap, and I'm going, oh, he's not like me. he's not like me. And I've got 2 days with this man still, you know, in this hotel room that we're sharing this room. I'm sleeping in the same room. And then I start doing what my old mechanisms used to be. Was like, oh, remember the Muhammad Ali Foreman fight and Fraser fight, and, you know, and then he starts talking to me again, you know what I mean? But that's life. It's like, it's not, okay, you could have that experience, that, but, you know, I'm not saying it didn't shape something, it certainly did for me, but it's also, I think there was a awakening up, like, oh no, I smell, like, actually, this, he is the way, my dad is the product of his environment, and he's, And that's the way he's going to, you know, continue to live and have these opinions about whatever.
After witnessing your dad suffering with what he did for alcoholism, how is it that you end up on a journey and then go on heavy drugs and becoming a smuggler and et cetera?
Yeah, I witnessed his alcoholism and never really associated addiction with, which is not really nice. I don't know how I sort of came to that conclusion, but... So when I started taking drugs, I thought as long as I'm not an alcoholic. So when I first started to smoke weed, for example, I was already had lots of the addictive traits, the characteristics of addiction. I was already like really attention seeking, you know, like attention seeking, looking for validation, you know, looking for validation, Now it's funny because some of these traits, you could say, are entrepreneur. Here's the thing with a lot of this stuff is, if the addiction's channeled in a positive way, and maybe work or being an entrepreneur, you could do really well. You could be very successful in life. And it's a weird thing because people always think, oh, addicts are weak willed. It's the opposite. They're very strongly willed, they're often very stubborn, and why I was saying about the traits of addiction is that I had a lot of that sort of myopic, sort of focus, obsessive, the overcritical mind, which you could say is unrelenting standards that can make people really successful what they do. If they're highly critical of themselves, they'll try and be perfectionistic. So I had a lot of that. Those sort of traits, the sensitivity, the heightened sensitivity, rejection sensitivity syndrome, really, or dysmorphia, where I'm thinking people are going to reject me all the time. So then you develop skills to not be rejected, because if you're in a gang or you're in a tribe or whatever it is, you adapt. Some people become comedians, some people become like best fighter. Like, I always try to fight because I was the best fighter then. There was a book back then called The Great Books of Hashish. And I remember at night time, I'd fucking shine a torch, and I'd be in bed and I'd be looking at these pictures of all the countries where hash came from, like Lebanon and Morocco and Nepalese temple balls and Kashmir and like from, you know, and there was some part of me was like definitely saying, I want to go to all these countries. I want to be in amongst and with the sort of locals, you know, in the hill tribes of these countries and be amongst loads of it, because I was so like, that it was such a sort of focus. So then I started selling, and then I got arrested when I was 17. I got arrested when I was 17, then I got arrested for intent to supply when I was 18, and then in possession of cocaine then as well. But then I went out and I started to get the money, and then I'd go out and I'd buy and I'd go to these. I mean, I remember the first time it was Amsterdam, and then bringing drugs back from Amsterdam, which was quite easy. And then a few times more with LSD from Amsterdam. And then I started going to India, and I'd be in, and it's a bizarre, like I'd be in, I'd climb these fucking, I'd be right up the Himalayas, right in these little villages where I'd, I remember this seat at this, in this guy's house, this seat around, but it was just a farmer really. And he took me back to his house. I'd heard somebody had said, oh, go and see this guy, Seton Arm. He'll sell you, and it'll be like this much a kilo. And I remember just him taking me into a room, and the whole wall, all the way up, was just fucking like about 200 kilo or 300 kilo of hash, Charis. And in my head at the time, thinking, oh, this is like fucking the best place in the world. There's nowhere I want to be but here, just smoking with this sort of farmer, really. I had girlfriends, but there was no girlfriend with me. It was just really focused on, and that progressed, and I wound up in prison in Spain in the later 80s. We're bringing hash back from Morocco and cars. I was always came from a position of financial insecurity because of the poverty that I witnessed. As a kid, I remember used to think, there is no way I want to be poor. This is like, I'd look at my mum and my dad and them struggling to get money really for like just general messages. So there was a thing about money, which has been all through, even to this day, I think that I have to keep making sure that money's not my higher power, because I know that it doesn't, it provides comfort and ease and whatever, but it, in itself, it's just a material, you know. But, and then the thing, the prestige, the kudos from other people, that people would think that I'm successful or that I'm cool, that I've got, that was the sort of ego enhancement that I got from it. But eventually, no matter how much money I got, there was a period where I had a chunk of money that I'd have enough money. I had about, back then, maybe about 80 or 90 grand. So it'd be equivalent to maybe, I mean, it's not like, it'd be like 300, 400,000 now. It's not really that much, but I had always this money coming in. There was always like lots of available money. But also what came with that is that my coke use, my alcohol use, and also what I'd done, because I'm a sort of people pleaser, and I sort of like looked after lots of people. I sort of helped lots of people who didn't have money. I had a whole group of travellers. I mean, there was a whole group of travellers that stayed in my house in Brixton, who every day I'd go out and get them kebabs and get them, like, buy them all alcohol, because they were like sort of, because I was so frightened. There were so many sort of yardies around that would turn you over. I wasn't really fighting so much of the police, actually, but it was, which was weird. But I had them around me as a sort of like security, really, that they would, because they loved the fight. It was like something out of Snatch. A few of them were like, the movie Snatch, where Brad Pitt's like, and he's a gypsy. There was a few like that from the travelling scene. And they loved a scrap, and I always felt, and all I had to do really is just give them tenants at Super Special Brewing Kebabs, and like, you know, as much alcohol, and they were around. But it was sort of mad times, and then it was connected with these Irish people who took me in. They were INLA guys, really, and I wound up getting more of a heroin habit. The Irish guys were like really anti. Back then, they were really anti heroin, were really pro cocaine. Yeah. I mean, but because a lot of them were taking cocaine, but they were really anti. They didn't trust that I would because the anti-terrorist squad were watching, you know, there was lots of stuff going on, and they so I got sort of like pushed out of that sort of group in a way. And then I went on my, I was always on my own really to some degree, but I went to India and I wound up in Thailand and the Golden Triangle, upside the Golden Triangle. And then by that point, I was just like hopelessly addicted to heroin, but in a place where it's really cheap, it's dirt cheap, and it's really strong. And then eventually I brought a lot back. And I mean, this is the crazy thing, what you do, the desperation that you get into, like crossing borders into Malaysia, into Thailand with drugs, out of India, internally inside me, enough to kill thousands of people, really. I mean, you know, if the packages sort of burst. But because I'm going to be so ill, I'm going to be so sick if I don't have it, I'm taking these mad risks. I mean, fucking crazy. When I think back now, I think, God, how did you?
It's like a death sentence.
Yeah.
Literally. And if it bursts inside you.
Yeah, yeah. But eventually, and then I got clean, and I went to luckily for me, the government provided this funded treatment. And then I met people who were in recovery, who'd been in recovery before, who'd relapsed, and one guy in particular. And from there, I sort of got clean. And then I basically, then I went to another rehab, and then I started to go to meetings, and I started to have lots of therapy over the years. And then I started to build, but I had no idea what to do, really, because all my life I'd been really committing crime, and some sort of crime, had lots of charges. And then I started to learn counselling. It's like, went to college, I'd done an A-level in English, started learning computer skills. I think at the time, I was really happy. I was so happy I got clean, you know, that I was like, when I'd broke the addiction, I'd got out, I was around sort of a girlfriend she's dead now, but she was in addiction. I'd broke the ties with her. I got away from her family. They were quite violent people generally.
So like pretty much like a clean start.
A clean start, brand new start.
Did you, with counselling, no, that's a...
Yeah.
What was the thought process? Because when you have an obsessive mind,
yeah,
it's either to get drink or drugs or to get in a relationship or how to manage it and how to do stuff. And for me, there was a massive landscape that opened up. And I'm like, wow, my brain is not occupied with myself or drug or drinks or how to talk to people, how not to do stuff. I had this like big open space.
Yeah.
And I wanted to fill it with good stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, how can I learn? What do I need to read? And what do I need to do? Is that a kind of the same thing, how you got into counselling?
I think some part of me thought, oh, I could turn this darkness into light. I could basically, because I know the despair, the desperation, you know, that sort of gift, the desperation, that pain that we get into. I know that if I could, so I thought, oh, let's, and also the thing is, which I didn't really know what to do. I really didn't know what to do. I sort of like got in, I started doing that as just like, what shall I do? I didn't want to come back to crime. There was a part of me what did want to go back to crime, but also knew I could make, because a part of me was going like, you could do this all sober now, you could do it all clean, and you could get, you know, connections, you know people, and you know people all over the place. You just need to get some capital and you could do, but then also I knew that I know what I'm like. I can't, like the likelihood is I can't stop. My previous tells me that once you, whatever money you get, you're going to want more. And if you're in amongst that circle, the same circle, if I'm doing the same behaviour, I'm thinking the same way as I used to think, and I'll feel the same way. So therefore, I'm likely to do the same thing as I've always done. So I didn't really know. And then I got into, and then I became quite sort of obsessed about learning and doing for years, for about 7 or 8 years. Basically just done course after course, became like a therapist and then a family, systemic psychotherapy, and then NLP, and then traumatology. Like there was a continue. Meanwhile, I was sort of building, I was working for other places, but then I started to build a practice. And then along the way, I also wrote the books. I'd met a few musicians. I'd met somebody that was part of a publishing house, and he was like a sort of famous musician. He says, look, you should write a book. And then I wrote that. And then on the back of that, he gave me a bit more credibility. I think basically I became workaholic a bit as well. My thing is, right, what I've got to really watch is when thing is about how I don't like how I take breaks and how, because my mind continually sees opportunities where I could do certain things. It feels sometimes a bit overwhelmed, the amount of things that I could potentially, things that I could maybe do. But then I know that some part of me thinks, oh yeah, I could do that and that, but there's a cost to it. It's time, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
How do I have quality time with my kids or my girlfriend or my friends? And, you know, what's the expense of it really? And what I realise is it's never, you know, although I've been free, I mean, really, I've had so much, my life in comparison, it doesn't bear, you know, like, I've certainly earned much more money clean than I did in my years.
Which is important to say.
Yeah.
Because a lot of youngsters think there's a fast track route to getting a lot of money.
Yeah.
And most of them don't succeed.
I know.
If you have really, that mindset, what you said earlier.
Yeah. When I've wound up in these prisons, right, what I've seen continually is people don't know when to stop. They say, I'm sure they say to themselves, right, and I know they do say to themselves because I've done it. They say, oh, when I get through this border, when I get this, and I'll be happy when I get whatever the figure is, right? But that's not what happens. Is what really happens is, they get that and they go, God, that's so, right, I've got 1 million or I've got 5 million, I want 10 million now. And they just keep on doing it and they stay in it and then eventually they wind up. I mean, lots of them that I was in this prison in Spain, Alarin in Malacca, and it was mad. There was just guys out in the courtyard every day. We'd be sitting around the courtyard and it was all like British, Americans and Dutch guys. And they'd be saying, oh yeah, I got arrested for a ton of hash. I was on a boat coming back from Morocco. And I would say to them, well, how many times? Obviously, like, it's not the first time. Oh yeah, I've been doing it for years, you know. And so obviously they've made a lot of money. They've got but then they eventually get caught and all their assets, if they can get all, they might still have, look, some of them are a bit wiser. They'll put the assets somewhere, country, and but nonetheless, they're still, you know, eventually it catches up with them. I think what happens is people, it's beyond the limits. They get restricted by the limitations of their imagination. They don't, they tell themselves a negative message. They can only achieve this. They sort of don't dare to dream, really. They don't sort of think out the box. And they stay in their comfort zone. If you stay in your comfort zone, then you're restricted because your fear, your sort of self-centered fear really stops you. But if you can sort of go into your sort of stretch zone and try and push yourself and believe and sort of visualize, almost like it's this sort of manifesting stuff, really. I think you can create. I think we've got the potential to really create stuff.
I totally agree. If someone's suffering from addiction or alcoholism, or they're not sure, but they're obviously on this path, what should they do for help?
Yeah, okay. So I think if depending on your people's financial situations. But if there's a lack of funds or like resort, then definitely there's lots of help. There's lots of the local authorities. You can get sort of sometimes funding for rehab, depending on what sort of catchment areas. There's speak to your GP, talk to your doctor also about if there's any sort of free counselling that you can get as well. There's lots of different self-help groups. I mean, there's just so many different free self-help groups, and and there's lots online on Zoom. Like, you can just put in like 12 step groups or SMART meetings. SMART is stands for self-management recovery training. It's a secular group. It comes from Rational Recovery. It's also free as well. So there's lots of free help out there. If you just put into Google or whatever or ask your doctor or phone, there's helplines. But, you know, and if you're in London and most of the country, really, these self-help groups are everywhere, really. And go along, just, you know, face your fear, the biggest step is the first bit, is asking for the help. The next bit is just getting yourself there. But also know that everyone that's there, whether it's 12-step groups or whether it's SMART groups, they've all had to reach out for help. There's no one to stay clean and sober a day at a time against an illness that's incredibly powerful. We need as much ammunition as possible, really, because, you know, when it's so embedded in your psyche, an addiction, you reinforce the same message about yourself and the same behavioural pattern over and over again. We need to sort of catapult ourselves out of that some way, and we need to find people that have done it. We need to find like-minded people who have walked that path, and there's loads of them out there. I'm one, Paul's one. There's loads of people that have done that, and they're the perfect people to help you because they know the pain. They've been in the dark side. You know, it's like, Darth Vader, the dark side. But it's a bit like, you know, we need to get sort of tooled up, armed up and you know, to combat it. But look, it's really possible. It's absolutely possible. Don't lose hope that you can't succeed. Don't think that, you know, you have to stay in this pain and misery.
Mark Dempster, thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Thank you.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up. And you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.